Carolina.
No one could be sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading from Growing Up with Chapel Hill, The Village, from 1901 to 1925. By Jane Toy Coolidge. Continuing Chapter 9, The Wide Blue Yonder. With the family visiting in Germany, about 6 years before the outbreak of World War I, there were other family outings, too, among them one to the airfield, where we saw some of the newly invented airplanes put on a show in which they flew round and round the field in defiance of all known laws of nature. This bizarre spectacle was so fantastic that it was considered just a freakish exhibition, a circus stunt, not to be taken seriously. Visits to Potsdam and Charlottenburg seemed more important, for palaces and mausoleums were historic landmarks. We learned about Frederick the Great and Bismarck, but what we really liked was the zoo. And as the winter wore on, visits to the theater. There were not many of these, for tickets were expensive, but the plays we saw transported us to fairyland, where sparkling lights, luxuriously elegant decor, and gay music combined to make a perfect setting for the dream world on the stage. Hansel and Gretel was pure magic, and the Wicked Witch's aerial flight was as miraculous as that of the planes that had circled the airfield. Then the German Christmas was upon us, and this, too, was like something out of a storybook. Frau von Rada celebrated it lavishly, and the tree in the pension was different from any we'd ever seen, all silver and white, and shimmering icicles dripping from its branches. It so charmed my mother that she adopted the idea for future trees at home. All the members of the household joined in the celebration. Goodwill and Gemütlichkeit prevailed, and we children received presents such as we'd never had before, games and toys made according to the German tradition of ingenious design and sound workmanship. One of my gifts was a little theater, complete with a red curtain that rolled up, several changes of scenery, cardboard actors manipulated by wires, and booklets containing rhymed texts of the plays, Cinderella, Snow White, and Puss in Boots. We ignored these stilted verses and made up speeches of our own. I also received a model schoolroom with desks, blackboards, teacher, and pupils. Calvert's most exciting present was a handsome toy castle, complete with moat, drawbridge, and tower manned by armored knights. There were luscious goodies, of course. Lebkuchen, marzipan, pfeffernüsse, and Baumkuchen, a chocolate confection in the shape of a large log covered with crunchy bark. All these treats combined to make the holidays a memorable time, and a letter I wrote to Mary Cobb, my playmate in Chapel Hill, tells about it. Berlin, Germany, February 2, 1911. Dear Mary, I hope you are well. We had a lovely Christmas. I got a doll theater and doll school. It was lovely of you to send me the doll cap. I think it will just fit my doll. Berlin is awfully big. I've been to the theater twice. I saw Frau Hurle and Hansel and Gretel. I do wish you were here to play with me. We can all speak German right well. I want you to write me a letter and tell me all about the Donnells and everybody. I go to school and am in the second class. I have forgotten how to spell. I hope you had a happy Christmas. Now I must say goodbye. Your friend, Jane Toy. We played with our Christmas treasures during the dark afternoons of the northern winter. Then, as spring drew near, they were packed up with our other possessions in preparations for a move. Packing apparently presented a problem, which my mother solved by buying a large, substantial wicker trunk. Goodbyes were said, and Frau von Rada wept, for she had become fond of us all, and especially my little brother, who seemed as dear to her as her own grandchild. But there could be no holding back. Tickets were bought, and we climbed into a compartment on the southbound train. In Dresden we gazed with respect at the Sistine Madonna, and in Nuremberg with horror at the Iron Maiden, that triumph of Teutonic ingenuity, the sight of which gave me nightmares for months. I pictured an unfortunate prisoner being jammed into this man-size iron cabinet, whose doors were fitted with huge spikes pointing to the inside. When the doors were closed, the spikes put out the man's eyes and penetrated other parts of his body. But there were pleasanter sights in Nuremberg, cobbled streets leading to waterways where swans swam serenely and gobbled up the bits of bread we threw to them. There were gabled houses and ancient towers against whose sides little restaurants like the Bratwurst Glucklein snuggled modestly, filling the street with tempting smells and the promise of Gemütlichkeit. Shop windows displayed beautiful and interesting wares, among which were outstanding collections of pictures. My mother was entranced by one of these, a print depicting an old man playing his violin to a group of children, who listened spellbound. The picture spoke to her. She longed for it, but it wasn't cheap. She shook her head sadly, and we all went back to the hotel. My father, who had seen the expression on her face, made a second trip to the shop and bought the picture, which now hangs in my son's house in Berkeley. The kindly old musician has played his tunes to three generations of children. Rothenburg gave us another taste, or rather a massive dose, of the medieval, and we swallowed it with gusto. Everything in this walled town was ancient. We ate and drank and breathed antiquity, climbing worn stone stairs in towers, patrolling the city walls, peering into suits of armor, and enjoying every minute of it. Then on to Heidelberg, where drifts of cherry blossoms covered the hillsides above the Neckar. Here we rented an apartment across the river from the city and settled down to housekeeping. A maid-of-all-work was hired, and arrangements were made with the milkman, the baker, and the grocer for the delivery of their wares. All such services were provided with systematic efficiency, quite different from the casual ways we were used to at home. Every morning the baker's boy hung out on our door a spotless white cloth bag filled with crusty rolls still warm from the oven. In their shops the grocer, butcher, and baker called my mother Gnädige Frau, bowed from the waist when they took her order, and, when bills were paid, gave us children cakes of chocolate. My brothers and I were enrolled in school, an experience much easier than it had been in Berlin, for now we could, as I had said in my letter to Mary Cobb, speak German right well. We were accepted by our teachers and classmates, and hospitably treated, but during our comparatively short stay in Heidelberg, we formed few close ties with them. Perhaps this was because we were so constantly occupied in exploring the city and countryside. First, the blossoming cherries, and then a succession of other trees, vines, shrubs and flowers made the valley natural paradise. No angel with flaming sword barred the gate. There were all sorts of interesting places within easy reach by foot, streetcar, or boat, and we took advantage of all these opportunities. Trips on the river were the ones we liked best. Day's outings on excursion boats to villages on the banks of the Neckar, where modest restaurants served picnic lunches with beer for my father, and goodies for us all. Neckar Steinach and Neckar Gemünd were two of these little towns, and another was Dilsberg, which was on the summit of a nearby mountain. Here we watched a folk play put on by local people who reenacted long-ago events against a background of the castle where these events had taken place. I suppose the performances were crude and primitive, for even a child could see that costumes were shabby and plumes bedraggled. But it was fun to watch them, and to know that the stones under our feet were the very same ones the legendary knights and ladies had walked on. In Heidelberg itself, the big, partly ruined castle on the hill above the city was our favorite objective, for here there were many things to see and unused corners to explore. In the deep cellar was a wine barrel the size of a small room, and near it the figure of an ancient dwarf who, if you shook his hand, thrust a foxtail in your face to your own discomfiture and the amusement of onlookers. My brother Calvert, wiser than I and more cautious, refused the attendant's invitation to touch the dwarf's hand, but I, more trusting or more foolhardy, accepted. On gala occasions there was a display of fireworks, and the castle was illuminated from inside with fiery red lights that shone through the empty windows. We watched this impressive scene from a safe spot far across the river. Our father took us to visit the university, too, and though we were so used to things that had to do with college that we weren't particularly interested, these old buildings, with their sheltered courtyards and stone steps worn down by generations of students, made a deep impression. Here, as in Rothenburg, we had a glimpse into another world, a world not of armored knights, but of scholars searching for knowledge and dedicated to truth. After 3 months, our stay in Heidelberg drew to its close, and we turned towards home, starting the journey with a trip down the Rhine. More hillside vineyards, ruined castles, pleasant villages, and then bustling Bremen. There, we boarded a modest one-class ship, whose name made it seem like our very own. It was the Neckar, and it took us safely on our way.
Bright lights were flashing in the grand ballroom. Softly the music, like sweet tunes. There came my sweetheart. I left my own.
Chapter 10, Growing Pains. Chapel Hill was drowsing away the hot August afternoon when the toys came home from Europe. The big square house, with its encircling porches, was a dear, familiar sight, and we children dashed through its rooms, looking for forgotten treasures. Most of these were in the attic, where family possessions had been stored, and we searched frantically among boxes and barrels for toys lovingly remembered through the year. What I wanted most to find was my collection of Letty Lane paper dolls, with costumes for all occasions. I thought I knew just where they were, but, search as hard as I could, I never found them. This was my first experience of tragic loss. But there was the joy of rediscovering other half-forgotten favorites, until we were called downstairs for a treat. Our neighbor, Mrs. Hume, had sent over a tall glass pitcher of lemonade, with lots of maraschino cherries floating in the frosty liquid. Never were returning travelers welcomed with a more elegant gift. There were other heartwarming welcomes, too, but my parents must have had mixed emotions as the days went by, for drastic changes had taken place during our absence. Chapel Hill had extended its sewer and water system to include the west end of town, a development long hoped for and heartily endorsed by my father and mother. But it could hardly have come at a less convenient time. These improvements meant that we could now have running water and an indoor toilet instead of the tin tub in the bedroom and the outside privy that had served us heretofore. The cozy comfort of a bedtime bath beside the fire is one of my earliest memories. Long trips to the privy in the backyard were less agreeable, but we accommodated ourselves to them, and the commodious three-holer made of smoothly planed planks was as comfortable as such a place could be. Now all this was to be changed. There was a bathroom on the first floor of the house next to the nursery, and here installation of water and sewer was a simple procedure, but there was no such room upstairs. A second-floor bathroom had to be built in the space over the pantries at the rear of the house. This presented no architectural problem, but there were difficulties of a different kind. It had to be paid for. To build a new room was an expensive business, and to this must be added the staggering cost of putting in the water and sewer systems. The house sat far back from the road, and long trenches had to be dug all the way down to Franklin Street. It all ran into a lot of money. The year in Europe had used up the family savings, and now my parents were faced with this huge expense. And face it they did. The new bathroom was built, equipped with an oversized tub and the usual other fixtures, including a small wood-burning stove. The stove was to be used only occasionally. On most brief visits to the room, we chose to shiver. We children were not told that there were financial problems. We accepted the fact that a young professor came to occupy one of the big rooms upstairs, and that there was no cook in the kitchen. These economies were my mother's way of coping with the situation, and they were successful. How long they continued, I do not know. Eventually, we had a cook again. But the young professor stayed, and as the years went by, was followed by a succession of others. The big house was paying its way, and there was still plenty of room for everybody. It was at about this time that my father's study was moved upstairs. Its former site, to the left of the front door, became what we called the sitting room, later to be more stylishly termed the living room, the most used and best-loved spot in the house. My mother had good taste and a liking for simple, sturdy furniture. There were a high-backed settle and a mission-style oblong center table made by native craftsmen in the Smoky Mountains, along lines of which William Morris would have approved. Above the settle hung a Nuremberg print, and on the shelves of the wide bookcases were assembled the family's favorite volumes. The room was warm and welcoming, orderly in a casual fashion, but never oppressively neat, with an atmosphere that one of my mother's friends once called a comfortable litter. The parlor on the other side of the front hall was elegant, formal, and a little chilly. The study on the second floor was my father's domain, with book-lined walls, a wide, flat-topped desk in the middle of the room, a couch at one side, and a small table with an early model typewriter by the back window. My father used this ancient machine year after year, producing neat transcripts until he died in 1933. With the opening of school in September 1911, I resumed my interrupted education, hitherto a spasmodic, haphazard, and highly unconventional process. Chapel Hill's school facilities were so limited that, to begin with, my mother, a former teacher, chose to teach me herself, starting with the alphabet and a primer which I still remember with vague distaste. The arrival of a new baby, my brother Walter, disrupted this plan, and, according to my mother's account, she was surprised one day to find me lying on my stomach engrossed in a storybook. She asked me what the story was about, and I gave her a complete resume. From then on, I read everything I could get hold of. This went on for a year or two, after which I was entered in the second grade, placed there according to age rather than knowledge. I could barely write, and of arithmetic I knew nothing. This mathematical vacuum was to plague me all my life. Somehow I managed to survive that year, and then I was deposited in the alien atmosphere of a Berlin Mädchenschule. What English spelling I knew was forgotten or confused with the idiosyncrasies of a new language, while my writing went from round English ovals into the fierce, sharp points of the German script. Now I was back in the fourth grade in the Chapel Hill School, and struggling to get my feet on the ground. The school building was a big old house southwest of the site of the present Carolina Inn, a former residence in which minimal alterations had been made to adapt it to its new use. It housed the whole school system, first through 11th grades, with most grades two to a room, and the high school in a single assembly hall made by knocking down several partitions. The third floor of the ramshackle building was an unfloored attic, where crossbeams gave precarious footing to youngsters escaping from study hours to prowl here in search of adventure. A year or two later, when I was one of those youngsters walking with a friend on the crossbeams, I missed a step, and my foot went through the flimsy boards and crashed into the ceiling of the seventh-grade room to create a near panic. I pulled up my foot and ran down to safety. There were no dire results, and I remember no punishment, but I had to stand a lot of teasing and the resulting embarrassment. I got through fourth grade, skipped the fifth, and ended up in the sixth, the normal place for one of my years. Here I was among friends of my own age, a congenial group who went happily into high school together. The old frame building stood on a big lot, bordered on one side by woods, and the other side sloping down to the street. Here we gathered at recess to eat our lunches and then play prisoner's base. And here I remember listening in horror to the account of a dreadful thing that had happened on the campus the night before, when sophomores, hazing a freshman, made him dance on a barrel, and he fell off, cut his neck on a broken bottle, and died. Back of the school, the ground was level enough for a primitive baseball field, and later an equally primitive basketball court, where a teacher full of new ideas taught us girls to play the game. She was Maud Minish, a large blonde young woman with blue eyes behind thick-lensed glasses. Of all the teachers I had in school and college, she is the one I remember best. Her big body perched sideways on a pupil's desk. She held an open history book in one hand, but never looked at it. Instead, she told us in her own living words about the Wittenagemot and the signing of the Magna Carta, waving her hands as she described the steps by which Englishmen had gained the rights they passed on to us, and making us feel a part of the panorama of history. Maud Minish was not only my teacher, she was my friend. As time went by, the difference in our ages seemed to grow less, and even when we went our separate ways, I to boarding school and college, she to other teaching positions, we kept in touch through letters and summer meetings. She was passionately interested in folk songs sung in the Carolina Mountains, ballads passed down from Elizabethan times, and kept alive in remote settlements. She had spent a year or two teaching in the hill country, and was making a collection of these songs. Her published articles about them laid the groundwork for further investigations for which later scholars achieved recognition after Maud's early death cut short her efforts. But for teenage girls in our little school, she was just a teacher who made dull subjects interesting and introduced us to organized sports. In white midi blouses and black serge bloomers, so generously pleated as to completely conceal the human form beneath them, we ran and jumped and slid around the sandy court, having the time of our lives. Other innovations besides basketball were coming to Chapel Hill, the most important of them all being the automobile. No longer were we dependent on Mr. Pickard's carriages to take us to the station. In fact, trips to the station were less frequent than they used to be, for Durham, just 12 miles away, was on the main line of the railroad, and you could get there in these new automobiles. Several enterprising men in the village, Mr. Brockwell, Mr. Pendergrass, and Tank Hunter among them, bought cars and went into the business of transporting passengers to and from Durham. The trip was apt to be hazardous and uncertain. You could never be sure the automobile would get through the mud hole at Stroud's Creek. Sometimes the driver would have to give up and make a long detour around by Hillsboro. Or he might have a flat, and we'd all get out to offer help and advice as he changed the tire. But the jitneys took their chances, crowded people into cars with blankets laid across the jump seats to accommodate 3 or even 4 passengers there, stayed in business, and prospered. Trips to Durham were exciting, and a spirit of shared adventure made them gay excursions. Of course, there were no paved roads, and even in town, Franklin Street was a sea of mud, beside which a wag once put up a sign, "Boats for Hire." All our streets were hard on shoes, and when we went shopping in Durham, people there looked down their noses and said they could tell where we came from because Chapel Hill shoes were always muddy. Chapel Hillians retorted that they put on their old shoes to go to Durham. The automobile was bringing the two towns closer together, and there was resulting friction, akin to old-time rivalry between town and gown. Durham was a rapidly growing industrial city, while Chapel Hill remained a modest academic retreat. Modest, that is, in size and wealth. In estimate of our own worth, I'm afraid we were pretty high-hat. Perhaps it was to make up for our limited finances that we stressed cultural advantages to a point dangerously close to intellectual snobbishness. But the university was coming out of its traditional cloisters to take an ever-increasing part in solving Carolina's practical problems. It was entering upon an era of extended service in education, rural economics, and methods of government. One of the early leaders in this movement was Marcus Cicero Stevens Noble, who saw the needs of the thousands of people on small farms and in isolated rural villages, and sought to provide new opportunities for them. He put his theories into practice at home, setting up a fall celebration called Rally Day, for which country people from all over Orange and Chatham counties came to Chapel Hill to display their prize products in Memorial Hall, to eat picnic lunches on the campus, to meet old friends and make new ones, to listen to speeches, and to carry home new ideas. A little later, Eugene Cunningham Branson extended the scope of such enterprises into a comprehensive program of educational progress for all rural North Carolina. In the university, many other changes were taking place. Dr. Venable resigned the presidency to be succeeded by Edward Kidder Graham, a youthful professor beloved by all who knew him, admired for his liberal idealism, and respected for his academic achievement. New buildings were erected, student enrollment increased steadily, and the faculty had many new members. Then, in 1914, Chapel Hill, along with the rest of the nation, was shaken by the outbreak of the war. Many faculty families had traveled abroad and had close ties in various European countries. For them, the impact of the Holocaust was especially great, and feeling ran high. But there was no great change in the community's way of life until the Lusitania was sunk and Wilson declared war. Then everybody plunged into action. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
I think I wish and hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.